Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is August 22nd, 2017. And today, I'm really happy to welcome back to the program my friend, James Howard Kunstler. You know Jim as a well-known author, social critic, whose ideas have been extremely influential to myself and the peak oil and sustainable living movements. His best-known work for myself is The Long Emergency, which really got me kicked off in many ways thinking about the things that led to the crash course. And in that book, he argues that declining oil production will result in the reversal of modern industrialized society and compel Americans to return to smaller scale. So he also wrote the book series that brings that concept to life that began with World Made by Hand, its sequel, The Witch of Hebron, and A History of the Future, and most recently, The Heroes of Spring, which use fiction to really entertainingly transport us into what a future of less might look and feel like. And that, to me, is a world with less net energy. He also wrote Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation, which is just reads like just a complete prediction of what we're in today as we look around the world. And of course, he continues to write regularly at his excellent weekly blog found over at Kunstler.com, where he now writes and posts twice a week. Jim, really happy to have you back on as a guest, particularly with everything going on today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, and let's get to it.
Well, let's get to it. So I think we just have to start on the social side of all of this. We've had the incidents at Charlottesville and the left and the right, Antifa, the alleged rise of Nazis. I say alleged because I'm not sure that there's more of them than there ever used to be, but the media is focusing on them. We just, if you remember, you have to think way back, like a month ago, it was Russia, 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 Russia. It was everywhere. Certainly we were about to, you know, this was the biggest danger ever. And then almost without skipping a beat, it was North Korea all over the airwaves. Everybody's getting really freaked out. And then it switched right over to Nazis. And here we are today. And I got to tell you, I know people personally who didn't skip a beat, just flicking from one of those traumas to the next and focusing on them fully. And what do you make of that?
Well, a couple of things. The failure of the Democratic end of the political spectrum is pretty spectacular. And I say that as someone who remains even now a registered Democrat. And I just find the implosion of what used to be the middle to be spectacular. And the adoption of really bad ideas by the remnants of the Democratic Party to also be just astonishing. So we've got people in that major party now who are affecting to believe that freedom of speech is no longer important, mm-hmm. and that the violence on the left is not has no equivalent to the violence of the right, which I happen to believe it does. And you know, I was not a Trump supporter; didn't vote for the guy. I've been dissing him continually in my own blog, but I think he was correct when he said that the misbehavior on both sides was pretty much the same. It may, you know, we may deplore the ideas and the ideologies of the Nazis, but the, you know, the First Amendment is all about having to tolerate ideas that make you uncomfortable. That's the whole point of it. And the idea that the left is no longer willing to be uncomfortable with other people's ideas is very troubling. So, you know, I've said for a while now that I thought that both political parties were kind of going down the laundry chute of history. And it seems like kind of a neck and neck race between who's going to get there first. But right now, it's sort of looking like the Democratic Party wants to get there first in terms of just sheer irrelevancy and incredibly bad ideas.
I totally agree. And I wouldn't want either of those two sets of characters that showed up in Charlottesville hanging out in my living room. I don't really like extremists, no matter where they show up. And you have one side intolerant for different reasons than the other side, who is also intolerant. You put two mixtures of intolerance together, and you probably have a volatile mixture. So yeah, I agree with all of that. And here's the thing, you and I both know that if we back out a couple of steps, we know that both parties are completely irrelevant because they're still talking as if we live in a world of infinite resources and all we have to do is tweak a few policies, you know, throw a little more money into the markets, goose the stock market a little higher, we'll get jobs going and everybody will keep just on with it, with the program as is. And I haven't seen anything from either of the two parties that even remotely begin to align with the reality of the world that we live in right now, which is where if you have my eyeballs, you notice a lot of the ecology is diminishing. It's like Mother Nature's retracting her web of life, and that's disturbing. You will notice that specific central bank policies specifically enrich the already rich who have financial assets at the expense of everybody else, because if we were honest, either party could come out and say, hey, the Federal Reserve is not a wealth creating organization. They are a wealth redistributing organization. And they've taken it from the many and given it to the few. And they think that's a good idea. Both parties are thumbs up okay with that. That's a shock to the system. Of course, these young people who grow up knowing that if they take on student debt, which is a requirement now to get ahead in this country, you will be the proud owner of the only non-dischargeable form of debt in bankruptcy court. Like, that's how we treat our young. And on the other side, my Obamacare premiums are slated to go up another high double digits this year. That's just going to keep going till it literally breaks the entire back of the middle to upper middle class. These are, Jim, to me, these are just shocks, 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 shocks. And the tragedy is that you have these people who don't know where the shocks are coming from, but they can look around and they see a Nazi or they see an Antifa leftist and they point their fingers at each other and they get all mad. But they're like two rats in a cage who just can't unravel where the shocks are coming from. So they fight each other. But they would do well to notice that these are systematically delivered shocks, and neither party is even remotely addressing anything about that, Democrat or Republican.
Well, I see that also, but and I have a way of looking at it. what we have here is our system dynamics that are in the driver's seat, and not personalities or offices. And what we're seeing is the behavior of people who have no idea what they're doing, and the system dynamics can be discussed, I think, pretty specifically. Most of the major systems that we rely on are entering a state of failure of one kind or another. And of course, the larger problem is that they're interlinked and that their failures will be mutual and self-amplifying. These systems include the energy system that has powered industrial civilization, the oil and gas industries, which you've talked about a lot. And I think that our listeners understand it pretty well. I don't think we have to rehearse that necessarily. Although the finer points of it, like the energy return of investment, is something that's certainly not understood by either the general public or probably most of the officers in the government. And certainly not in the, you know, the New York Times, Washington Post, or other, you know, major media outlets. They just don't get that. But, you know, all of that energy problem is reverberating in things like agriculture and our ability to use the oceans in some way that is not going to destroy the oceans. The medical system, the education system, all these systems are really kind of blowing up. In the absence of being able to run coherently in an economic way, they've turned into rackets. That basically means that people are trying to run them and make a profit off of them dishonestly one way or another. And because we're immersed in comprehensive dishonesty in our culture, we're no longer really recognize what we're doing or what the truth of our situation is. So it's pretty dismaying to see culture flounder and particularly to flounder in trivialities and bad ideas.
Yeah, well said. So, I mean, we really have a pretty significant metabolic disease going on here, where the significant force of motivation for our body, the thing that animates us, our very lifeblood, has diminishing returns, as you just wrote about in a piece titled Diminishing Returns. So we have that happening, and we should be detecting that and coming up with coherent strategies for that. And instead, you know, my personal, when people ask me, hey, Chris, how you doing? I say, oh, I'm fine. You know, but if you get a little deeper, I'm like, I'm disturbed. I'm really disturbed that this many years into what seems to me to be a fairly easily analyzed system failure problem, right? Which is that we have a complex system. It requires energy to feed it. And we have no comprehension at any level of power of the power structure that says, wow, we can't run that model forever. In fact, if we look at it properly, we might say, hey, we've detected the early symptoms of system failure, organ failure here. And so what are we going to do about that? And the answer is shriekingly more of the same, with an extra heaping of divide and distract, divisive politics thrown in just to make sure everybody's not really paying attention.
Well, it's very easy to see how this moves thoroughly through all levels of the culture. And one of the examples that I think is most visible right now is the way we're thinking about the car culture and transportation, personal transportation. And the so-called solution to the problem of, oil, the internal combustion engine, pollution and climate change, you know, the purported solution is electrifying the car system. And that's something that seems to be believed by, you know, the people of all classes and the media and people in government. You know, we're all sort of striving to get to that point where the car system is totally electrified. You know, that's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for financial reasons. It's not going to happen for ecological reasons. But we never think about living in walkable communities. And we never think about altering the living arrangement that we're stuck with and that we've overinvested in. And, you know, that's really what's going to, we're going to be compelled to do that, whether we like it or not, to return to traditional living arrangements, but we're not willing to think about it. I just came back from France a couple of weeks ago, and I spent time in a small town about 60 miles from the Mediterranean. And it was a walkable community. You didn't need to get in a car to get anything. The level of civilization there was so much, was demonstrably so much higher than anything you find in the United States. And the people, you know, for all the troubles they may be having in Europe, the people genuinely seemed better adjusted, happier, more content with reality, and more likely to be able to continue living in the decades ahead. There was not even much of the kind of visible pathology that you see in the flyover place that I live in. You know, I live in rural upstate New York, flyover America, where clearly more than half the people in the county are morbidly obese. And, you know, you didn't see that at all in France. And, you know, why is that? Well, it's because, you know, they don't hop in their car 16 times a day, and they actually have to move their bodies around. And you know, they're not all going on 11-mile hikes or spending the whole day in the gym. They're just going about their daily life. But, you know, it hasn't made them morbidly ill. So, I don't know. We're really not able to think about any of the systems problems that we have. You know, agriculture is one of the more interesting ones because so much of our bad behavior in agriculture, you know, industrial farming, mega farming, you know, giant animal food factories, giant pig farms, you know, all of these terrible things are not sustainable. And they're heavily subsidized by the government, and nobody is really interested in the one thing that would probably do the most good, which is smaller farms, more localized agriculture, done with more human attention, less mechanical intervention, And that's where history is going to be taking us anyway. And it's pretty obvious. And we're not getting any encouragement for the practitioners to get to that point, to go there. You know, we're just giving them incentives to stay away from that. So I'm not very optimistic about the systems problems that we face.
You know, that whole idea of we're just going to Elon Musk, Happy Motor, Tesla, electric car, way back into a more brilliant future. I find that one really, really hard to swallow, because all you have to do is literally spend 10 minutes reading a couple articles about the actual numbers involved. And you discover quickly it's a delusion. And the ferocity with which most people cling to that delusion is telling. And so it feels to me like our country is really headed towards a midlife crisis. And they talk about midlife crisis as if it's a bad thing. Crisis, it's a crisis. But a good thing that can come from a midlife crisis is you might wake up and go, hey, wait a minute. I've been doing everything I thought I was supposed to do. I'm not actually happy. I'm not actually healthy. Maybe I should fix those things. I only have one life. Hey, maybe I should start leading it the way I want to. So by the numbers, right? You talk about the number of morbidly obese. I recently wrote about the number of people, 1 in 6, Jim, 1 in 6 on psychoactive compounds in the United States, right? That's a pretty high number. You look at how the opioid deaths have now overtaken auto accidents and gun deaths by both, you know, suicide and intentional homicide and things like that, and accidents. So it's the number one leading cause. And, you know, there've been some, you know, sort of, this is the mark of, to me, of a really sick culture. You know, I think Trump said, oh, it's an epidemic. We're going to look at it. And various states have sort of said, oh, we have an opioid epidemic. But if you really peel that back, it's very unsavory what you find under there. You find pharma companies that know they make a ton of money off of opioids because they tend to be a lifelong addictive thing, and you can make a lot of money selling them. And various companies that are in the business of manufacturing some of these drugs have specifically spent a lot of money in the anti-marijuana legalization campaigns in various states, because they know, the data shows clearly, that when people have access to legal, very safe cannabis, that they can get off of the opioids. So, and this is all okay. We live in a culture where it's okay for a company that makes an addictive compound that kills people to give money like that, and nobody shames them and runs them out of the country club, and they aren't just pilloried as disgusting exemplars of humanity. Instead, they're actually, I think they probably enjoy very comfy lives as genius executives of successful companies. And to me, it's a very emblematic of what's going on here. But when you add it up, we're the most over-medicated, most overweight, least happy by every measure, least satisfied, least content. So maybe a midlife crisis would be a good thing right about now.
Well, the midlife crisis is one model for understanding this, but there is probably another one. Now, I have not really participated that much in therapeutic culture. You know, I've never had to be a 12-step program guy. I've never been a, you know, substance addict or anything like that. But it seems to me that probably a better model than the midlife crisis is the model of the, you know, the addict that has to hit bottom before they will make any changes in their life. And sometimes they don't. You know, in fact, probably more often than not, the morbidly addicted person just simply fails. You know, they die, they lose their life, they're ruined. But some people do hit bottom and find a way to bounce up. And so what we've got, you know, since I haven't been involved in the 12-step program, I do know a little bit about enabling behavior. And I think what we've got is enabling behavior that is combined with racketeering, which gives a tremendous amount of incentive to the enabling behaviors that you're describing in, you know, for example, for the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, those two dynamics form a kind of nexus of pervasive dishonesty in a culture that can't tell itself the truth about where it's at.
Well, we're number one in the United States. We know that.
Well, you know, we're number one in an awful lot of bad behavior that's, you know, destroying our culture, destroying our economy. So we can continue to believe that we're number one, but it's not going to really help us get to where we have to get. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to help us understand that, The solution to our living arrangement problems is not going to be more cars of a different kind, that it's going to be, you know, returning to traditional towns and neighborhoods, and that the solution to the agriculture problem is not going to be bigger pig farms. It's going to be, you know, smaller farms distributed more equitably around the parts of the country where you can still do agriculture. And the solution to the medical problem is not going to be larger combined corporate hospital chains and so-called provider services, but is probably going to be more like local clinics with brave doctors who are willing to actually look at their patients and touch them and not spend their whole career buried in their laptop or you know, dickering with insurance companies. The solution to the college problem is probably going to be that fewer people are going to go to college, and that college is once again, if it continues to exist at all, going to be a more or less elite experience. And we just have to, you know, understand that college may not be for everybody. That's just a highly unrealistic idea, and there's no evidence that sending more people to college is actually helping our economy. It's only kind of furnishing a fantasy for politicians to hide behind while they try to figure out what else to do. And they don't know what else to do. But, you know, a good thing would be if we were able to get regular trades going again in this country and revive local economies so that they had many a finely grained, many-leveled, many-layered system, that there would be more jobs for people, there would be more businesses that could be formed, there would be more social roles and economic roles that people could play. There would be opportunities for kids to get into vocations that required something like an apprenticeship so that they could learn from the people who are already doing doing carpentry, doing plumbing, doing things that are, you know, on the ground, important things, rather than just getting into bureaucratic niches or marketing or shuffling paper or shuffling investment accounts or doing, you know, a lot of unnecessary and kind of dumb things that don't really add anything to the economy. But we don't want to do any of those things. You know, we just want to kind of furnish this fantasy that if you just go to a community college, you'll come out and be able to work as a marketing drone for Old Navy. So, you know, our fantasies are really getting in the way of our ability to find a way to make the transition into whatever the next economy is going to be. And, you know, I think you and I would agree that it's going to be an economy of probably less stuff than we have been wallowing in for the last 30 years. But, you know, that might not be the worst thing in the world.
Well, let's turn back to this college experience for a second. You know, my wife and I, we homeschooled our children all the way up through high school, I guess, because they all went off to community college at the age of 16, each of them. But we did that because we looked at the way that the school systems were choosing to teach. And having read the books of John Taylor Gatto and really understanding that a school is as it's being practiced, is a Prussian model. It's very much designed to churn out people of a certain sort of bent with a certain amount of knowledge. And when you look at the way they do that and the various adjectives you would use to describe the creatures that come out of these public school systems very often, or even good private school systems, they're obedient. They know that there are right answers and wrong answers. They've been trained to believe that that what you have to do is prepare yourself to get a job, right? That doesn't prepare you to be an entrepreneur necessarily. Although those are the people we look to most. We're like, wow, look what Bill Gates did, or you know, most of the people we really look up to, we're all entrepreneurial in mindset. And it really teaches a faith in authority, that the right answer is at the front of the room and you have to follow the rules. And it does all that stuff. So it does all this wonderful acculturating stuff that when my wife and I looked at it, we looked at this future that you see, that I see, many people see, and we go, wow, wait a minute. Some descriptors for that future might be, you want to be creative, adaptive, free thinking, you know, really, really open-minded in a lot of ways. And our belief, which is part of the homeschooling belief system, is that learning's natural. You know, school is optional. As long as you know how to learn, as long as your curiosity is there, listen, you can learn anything you want online.
That's
in 10
a great
minutes,
way to put it.
You know? So you had some experiences going to colleges where I think you had a fairly successful, at least fairly full calendar of going and speaking at colleges, but that dried up on you at some point. And I think that's too emblematic of sort of a shift, or was it a shift in how colleges are operating, or was it an exposure of how they've been operating? And talk to us about that experience.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not that special. You know, I actually have a lecture agent, and I've been told that they're having a problem with many of their authors, and especially their environmental authors, that the deans and the department chairs at the colleges just don't want to invite speakers on campus who traffic in ideas that make the kids uncomfortable. Hmm. And they, you know, their experience with it has been so difficult and probably in some cases ruinous that they just don't dare to do it right now. So, you know, so people like me who are offering ideas that are not comforting, well, we're just out of luck right now. And, you know, the kids are maybe out of luck too, because they're not hearing these ideas. So I do want to say something about a point you made a minute ago, which is you kind of suggested there was a kind of a transect of work between being an entrepreneur and having a job. And that's probably true. You know, I mean, there are people who are absolutely self-directed, and then there are people who are directed by others. But there's something in between, too. And it actually used to probably be at some point in human history, and for a long time in human history, the larger group. And that is, there's something called a vocation between being an entrepreneur and just having a job. And having a vocation means being something that you're interested in, that you're good at, that you've worked to become good at, something that is of practical use to other people. And you know, a dynamic relationship between you and the world that is comprehensible, understood, and productive, and allows you to thrive. So the real question for young people right now is, what can you do that will allow you to thrive in the years ahead? And I think they have to ask this question in a pretty clear-eyed and hard way. And it's probably not going to be just going to college.
Well, particularly if college is going to be preparing you for a job set that doesn't really exist out there. You know, when I look into the future, I see a future of less. And I know you think our audience is pretty well versed in this, but let me just cycle back to it really quickly, because it's a very dominant narrative, a piece of programming that even Donald Trump said, the United States is now an oil exporter, which is false. We do export some oil, but we import even more than that. So on a net basis,
not
a net exporter. So kind of a faux pas there, but it's okay. The marketing has been so good on this point that I believe it's 2012 State of the Union. Obama said, you know, United States is now energy independent, because they lumped all the energy sources together and came out on a slight plus side on a BTU basis, which is meaningless when you're talking about energy. But one of the more important charts I've seen showed that for the shale operators, every single year from 2012, one thing has always been true. The revenues they've gotten from operations have been less than the cost to run their business. And so even though they say, well, we're drilling successfully for 40 now, but the cost of operations is still 50 and they're still getting 45 at the wellhead or whatever. So you look at this chart and it says they've been losing money every single year they've been in business. And so that's kind of the law of receding horizons. Like, no matter what the horizon is, well, we'll make tons of money when oil's 70. Yeah, but it'll cost you 80 to get out of the ground. It's the magic of the business, whatever. And we can detect that so easily when you look at the absolutely skyrocketing debt offerings and equity offerings they've had to put forward to stay in business. And Wall Street's continued to funnel that. And of course, Wall Street makes money at this, because they help pitch all of this. They help do the equity offerings, they underwrite the debt offerings, and then they sell them off to hapless future victims. And it's just astonishing to me, Jim, that we have very intelligent analysts who look at this. How can you look at a chart that says a business that has lost money every single year it's been in operation is one you want to throw hundreds of billions of dollars of new equity and debt into on a yearly basis? It's just astonishing to me. But the main point is this: The shale business is a bust. It has been. It's produced a lot of oil. It's produced it at a loss, and that's not a healthy thing. And that's tied into the Eroy story at a deeper level. But it's just astonishing to me how many people think that shale has now saved the world, saved the bacon. We can safely go back to sleep forever, or maybe at least another 3 decades.
Well, what you're describing really is not so much the effect of the shale industry on the national psychology, but the effect of advertising. And, you know, I don't think we pay enough attention to the fact that America is a culture that pretty much gave birth to the industry of advertising as a kind of a national enterprise. And, you know, we've been sucked into believing our own advertising, which in many cases is just dishonesty and nonsense. So we have a giant industry that is dedicated to producing disinformation and nonsense, and we're conditioned to accept that nonsense. And I think that's a simple explanation for it. You know, and there are a lot of people who are employed at it, and there are a lot of people who benefit from that. And I think as a kind of a political question, it's going to be a threshold issue where eventually we reach a kind of a critical mass of nonsense, and then stuff just flips. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're in a new world. It's the old Schopenhauer model, which is that new ideas are first greeted with ridicule, and next they are violently opposed, and next they are accepted as self-evidently true. Mm-hmm. And you know, the flip is just so complete. There's no cultural memory left of when you believed something that was not true. And so, you know, that I think that's what is going to happen. My own guess is that it's going to involve the disorder in the financial realm, because finance is kind of the lifeblood of this techno-industrial society we live in. And when that gets into trouble, the problems are going to thunder through all the other realms of our culture, and then we'll be forced to pay attention. And I think that financial those financial disorders are not far off, and that when that happens, things are going to change. And you and I think have been quite frustrated over the last 8 years at the ability of certain authorities in our culture to manipulate prices and levitate markets and intervene in the the physics of our economy. And that just can't go on forever. And even though it's frustrating to watch, it looks to me like it's kind of climaxing. What to me is kind of the tell of the whole thing is just the presence, the existence of Trump as president, the election of Trump, and what that tells me is that the disorders that are already present in our economy are manifesting now in our politics, and that to me is a pretty dangerous sign. You know, it's like when you have a metabolic disease, a chronic metabolic disease that all of a sudden really starts to present shocking and alarming symptoms, and that should be an alarm to us that we're really in trouble, and that it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah, well, so then Trump becomes the yellowish, orangish hue on the skin of a cirrhosis victim.
Yeah, but and also, you know, I mean, he's in a peculiar historic situation, because he's also going to be the guy holding the bag for all this, you know, when it does begin to seriously unravel. And you know, he was kind of, you know, history or fate kind of put him in office as the designated bag holder. I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for him, but I think that that's what's going to happen, and that's how he's going to be viewed. You know, he'll be left with this heap of smoldering problems and wreckage. And, you know, I think that's how it's going to play out. I would not be surprised if it played out in the remaining, you know, 5 months of the year.
So I don't think he's going to make it through his whole term, obviously.
Yeah, I don't either.
He's got the whole apparatus of the deep state arrayed against him. He's got every major newspaper outlet. He's got both parties. He really doesn't have any allies that I'm familiar with at this point in time. And, you know, what's astonishing to me is to just see the level of absolute hypocrisy that's so transparent, of course, right? So we had John McCain come out and excoriate, like, the president, you know, sided with Nazis. And I couldn't find anything in Trump's statements that said that. He said something that you hearken to, which is kind of like, hey, both sides got, you know, looked like they're kind of at fault here. And I don't know
What he said, excuse me for interrupting, but what he said that was so obnoxious, especially to the mainstream press, was that there were, quote, good people on both sides. And, you know, there were Nazis on one side and there were, you know, Antifa and Black Lives Matter and other players on the other side. And my guess is that there are probably, you know, a few people on the conservative side who are not terrible Nazis, you know, who had a sincere belief that, you know, the statue of Robert E. Lee ought to be allowed to remain in place, you know, for reasons that were not Nazi reasons. And there were people on the other side who were probably had good intentions too. But, you know, there were a lot of people, there are a lot of other people who are interested in making trouble. But I don't know. It was a hugely overblown conflict, and it's to me just more evidence that this organism called the deep state really wants to run over Trump with the 25th Amendment, and they're pretty determined to do it, and they're just waiting for anything that he might possibly do that would, you know, qualify him to be run over by the 25th Amendment.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, so as somebody who has a slightly longer memory than the average, I guess. The person who really just sort of made this emblematic for me was John McCain, right? And so John McCain came up and said, well, what the president said, this equivalency, blah, blah, you know, we have to just condemn Nazis wherever they are, right? And of course, John McCain was the person who was seen in Ukraine in the fall of 2013 after Yanukovych failed to sign the association agreement with Europe. And it was only a couple months after that Yanukovych was run out of town, hop, skip, and a jump between Yats, and then now onto Poroshenko, and you have militias running all over Ukraine on the eastern side, on the western side, that are displaying openly Waffen SS insignia and swastikas in the whole nine yards, right?
Yeah, but there are Nazis.
And nobody said boo about that. Not even the New York Times wrote one single article that I could find about that saying, hey, this is awful. We should condemn this wherever this arises. But the United States specifically supported the side and is continuing to support the side that has open Nazi affiliations and with people whose prime hero on that side of the country, the Bandera, you know, was a full-blown fascist Nazi kind of a guy. So at any rate, it feels to me like the thing that I find embarrassing about that is that if you're a bully that goes out and allows, you know, foments Nazism somewhere else, and then there's one tiny little rally by comparison in your own country and you flip a nut over that, you're the equivalent of the bully who says, only I get to throw punches. I don't want any blowback. I don't want anybody taking a swing back at me. I don't want to experience any pain of my own. I just want to export pain. I don't want any here, right? McCain sort of symbolized that whole thing for me. He's just an awful human being who has never seen a war he didn't want to impose on somebody else, but then gets on his high dunderous horse and really professes to be very upset when he sees similar things sort of echo back home. It just, again, I think we need to take a good hard look that if you're going to export this kind of stuff to the rest of the world, you have to be aware you're a violent culture and you got to look that in the face. You know, you can't say, no, we only want peace, love, and tolerance for all and be who we are in the world.
It begs the question why we can't examine that and why we can't look at it. And I think the answer is there are cycles in history and they follow, you know, some of them follow sine, cosine waves of, you know, troughs and hills and troughs and hills. And one of the cycles I think we're seeing here is that there are times when a culture or a nation or a people have a very poor sense of what's happening to them and have a very poor ability to articulate where they stand in history and the forces that are at work upon them. And that's where we're at. We're at a low point in that sine cosine waveform of a nation's ability to understand what's happening. And there are times when countries have a better idea of what's going on for various reasons. You know, I think that we had a pretty good idea of what we were doing in the Second World War. you know, and because of that, we had a much firmer consensus about how we were going to behave in society. And so people look back on the, you know, the 40s and even the 30s, the period of the Depression, people look back on that and they kind of marvel at the strength of the social consensus and the decency of the ordinary behavior of the people in the street and the social norms that existed then. And, you know, you look at our time and the social norms have deteriorated so badly and people don't know how to behave and, you know, people don't know how to behave in public and we clearly don't know what's happening to us. As we started this conversation talking about the kind of systemic failure of all of the subsystems that we depend on, you know, which are interlinked, I don't think we have any understanding of that. We don't have any understanding of the true picture in the energy scene. We have no sense of what we're doing to ourselves with our terribly destructive industrial farming. We have no idea how we're destroying the intellectual life of this nation in the universities with its, you know, Maoist fascist thought police and its antipathy to free thinking and free speech. You know, we have no idea how of the depths of depravity in the medical rackets that are going on. So, you know, all of these systems are in terrible condition and above them all is the financial system that is full of corruption, dishonesty, accounting fraud, and racketeering. And we're allowing all of these things to go on because we don't know what else to do.
And all the central banks can manage to do is just keep jamming the markets, you know, over and over and over again. And we know for a fact that you've got the Swiss National Bank, Bank of Japan, openly admitting that they step into markets and buy equities at key moments to make sure they always go in the right direction, which is up. And the level of pushback from the political class is zero around these activities, even though what's happening is what they're doing is they're redistributing wealth aggressively and very, very rapidly to a very tiny elite. And that's not that's not a good recipe for social cohesion and stability or even that primal sense of fairness that's really important for us to not be. A lot of this anger I see going on out there is because we know this is it, the people are right. It's a deeply unjust system. I think they've misdiagnosed the cause. I think they've been a little shallow in their thinking. But this is a decaying, you know, decrepit sort of a system, and we need to face that up. It's terrifying to know you're in a rusted out bucket bolt of a car that's careering down a slalomy mountain course. You know, that's terrifying.
Well, that's why I said that Trump represents the political manifestation of all that discontent and the apprehension, the recognition that there are things that are very wrong. And as I also said, you know, having lost our ability to articulate what that is at this particular moment in history. I do think that the deformations and interventions of the central banks are eventually going to have a consequence. And I listen to a lot of financial podcasts, and what's missing in many of them is the sense that any of that activity actually does have consequences. And to me, it pretty clearly points in one direction, and that is the destruction of currencies. And I do think that that's probably going to be the next thing on board. You know, it may initially manifest as, a bond market calamity or a bond and stock market calamity. But eventually, I think it's going to manifest in people simply losing their faith in what passes for, quote, money. And money will lose its legitimacy, just as politics is now losing its legitimacy in the USA. And so that points to kind of two directions. You know, one is a real global and worldwide currency fiasco and a great deal of political disorder. And, and they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, they're more likely to happen in concert than one or the other. So I think that that's pretty much where we're headed.
And of course, all of this can go on a lot longer than we think, because this isn't just a bubble that's popping. So bubbles go further than you think. There were railroad bubbles, tulip bubbles, real estate bubbles, you name it. And each of them had a certain arc and a trajectory, but this is the mother of all bubbles. It began with a delusion that was instilled back in the late 70s, early 80s, which was that we could grow our credit markets at twice the rate of our underlying economy. And it was a grand experiment, and everybody sort of participating at this point. And China really just roared into the story and said, yeah, man, we can show you how to really do this right. And of course, it's a mass delusion, because debts represent something you have to pay back in the future, or you face a currency crisis. Those are your options. And the whole world is now participating in this idea that somehow the world is going to be able to meet the needs of a financial system that really lost its moorings a long time ago. And that's a hard thing to sort of swallow. And it's very, very difficult to give up the dream of the bubble, because the root of a bubble always for humans is not a financial thing. It's a sociological condition. And it says this: there is such a thing as a free lunch. You don't have to pay stuff back. You can live beyond your means forever, right? And you don't have to ever question if tulips are actually what the intrinsic value of a tulip really is, right? Or any of that. And so here we are. And that's why this bubble isn't one that just sort of began a few years ago. The so-called housing bubble, that wasn't the bubble. That was a side bubble. It was a bubblette on the side of this credit bubble that has been going forever and ever. And so that's the only delusion that needs to be pierced. People need to be able to square up to this one idea. Can you constantly compound your claims on the future forever? The answer is no. It's a finite planet. But can you do it even more rationally at twice the rate that your underlying economy is growing forever? The answer is no. But that's the story that the entire financial market has been attempting to perpetuate and doing a reasonable job at by the numbers, but a terrible job at by any sort of logic in this story. So that's what we live in, an illogical world where if you dare to think about it for a minute, it falls apart pretty quick.
Well, I think what we're seeing is more like the master bubble of industrial civilization. And that's what makes it so dangerous and foreboding, because it's really the climax of about 300 years of a particular phase of human history that seems now to be coming to an end. You know, we're going to be moving into something new. I don't think that it's going to be the, you know, the Ray Kurzweil singularity era of transcendent machine intelligence and endless energy and expansion into all the parallel universes. You know, I personally think it's going to be world made by hand. And by that, I mean a significant time out from our idea of what progress has been. And whatever historical experience we had as a species for what preceded the techno-industrial fiesta and the things leading up to it has been kind of lost. So we really can't imagine that there's any other way to behave. The debt bubble of the last 40 years, you know, which is, you know, like a giant carbuncle on the techno-industrial world, was at first something that seemed like a good idea, but then something that seemed to be imperative to keep on doing, because if we didn't keep on doing, the system would collapse. And, you know, I think that's exactly what we're seeing with that. And that has kind of lost any kind of coherent reason other than desperation. So, you know, when desperation is the only thing that is propelling you forward, that's not a very good thing. And we don't have a plan. We don't even have mini plans for the you know, the various parts of our culture that might even be fixable. And so we're just kind of sleepwalking into the future.
Very well said. And let me wrap this up by saying that I think that as a social animal, humans, like sheep that can smell wolves over the hill, we've detected something, and a lot of people are reacting to that. And that's where I feel the anxiety and the energy and the emotional content is really coming from. And shame on the media for just running with that and whipping it into, you know, frantic, useless directions on a weekly
basis. It's
really
tragic. It's tragic because the what we call the news media really, you know, in the best times and in the best sense, has functioned as the sensory organs of our culture, telling us, you know, giving us a clear picture of actually what's out there. And, you know, I personally think that it's a manifestation of the diminishing returns of technology, that now that we have all of this information, you know, supplied by the web and computers, that we're absolutely unable to make any sense about of where we stand, and especially in those organs that are supposed to provide it, the news media. They're just, the failure is really epic. So, you know, that's another tragic element of the diminishing returns of technology, and another thing that we're on, another system that we're unable to pay attention to.
Absolutely. And so the more you watch television at this point, probably the less well-informed you are if you're watching the news media, particularly CNN and those other things. And I don't know what they're doing, whether they are actually maliciously and perniciously horsewhipping people around just for sport or because of some other ulterior aim that's
provided
by that.
No, I'll tell you one thing that's clear that's going on. And, you know, I can't be the only one who's noticed this, but have you noticed that the major cable news networks no longer have correspondents in the field? You know, when you used to turn on Huntley and Brinkley or Walter Cronkite, you know, back in the 70s, the news was about what was going on in the world and in the nation. And they had people around the world and around the nation who, you know, they would tune into and they would report about what was going on. They don't do any of that anymore. All they have are these panels of people who are giving their opinions. You know, so every night CNN or Fox News says, and now it's time to turn to our panel, you know, after reading a couple of headlines. And that's all it is. So, you know, they've tried to downsize their operation so severely that there are no correspondents left. And there's nobody out there collecting real news. There's nobody out there really observing it on the ground. So it's no wonder that we don't know what we're doing and what's happening.
Well, I think that they also have noted their increasing irrelevance there over at CNN et al. And one response to that is to say, well, tell us what works. And the only spaghetti that's sticking to the wall is the one where they basically inflame things. So they've basically just become just like little stage operators whose only job is to get any reaction they can.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that a guy like Anderson Cooper is not ashamed of what he's doing, because he's clearly not a stupid person. Yep. You know, it may be the, you know, the so-called Overton window of acceptable thinking that prevents him from seeing it, you know, otherwise known as, you know, the echo chamber of received ideas. But, you know, it's hard to understand why some of these people who are intelligent don't get the nature of the echo chamber they're serving.
Well, we'll probably see Anderson do one of my least favorite things, and we'll call it the reveal all retirement speech. You know, now that I'm on the retirement dais giving my last speech, let me tell you what I really think. Like, thank you very much. That would have been awesome years ago, but now you're irrelevant. So shut up. I hate that particular speech.
Well, you know, the thing is that this is essentially dishonorable behavior. And there doesn't seem to be any interest in calling out dishonorable behavior in our culture.
Mm, good point.
So, I mean, that's something that has to happen. There has to be kind of a general recognition or a consensus about what actually is decent behavior, what actually is okay. And, you know, the only things that we're interested in right now are kind of meaningless platitudes like, you know, you're a racist, or you're a racist, you're a Nazi, you're a fascist, you're this, you're that. And, you know, those things are no longer meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Well, with that, let's direct people to your excellent website and blog so that they can read you and follow you if they don't already.
My website is www.kunstler.com, kunstler.com. I actually have a new book out called A Safe and Happy Place. And, you know, it's a departure from what I have been doing, but I wanted to do it. It's a novel set on a hippie commune in Vermont in the late 1960s, and it's narrated by the 19-year-old girl at the center of the story. And I think it's good summer reading. You know, I'm a full-service writer. I like to do a lot of different kinds of things, and I wanted to write that novel. So there it is.
Excellent. All right. Well, with that, Jim, thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure talking to you as ever.